years after the Reformation, gingerly beginning to face the modern world. The Jewish world has had, well, from the period of enlightenment, which so-called, and when nation states came into being, so that citizenship became important. And you had the breakdown of the tight Jewish world, which was wiped out by the Holocaust. This means that whoever, there are many very able, observant Orthodox Jews who are not yet able to break through. I don't know whether you read the Jerusalem Post.
Yes, I get it every week.
Well, Moshe Cohen is always saying what I won't say. I never see him that I don't have to praise him, and I often write to do it, because there is a young group of observant Jews who recognize that halakha can always be stretched to fit. What you need to know is what the basic reason for a law was. Then you face the reality of today and see how that law applies. And if you want an example, I have a sister in Baltimore who was absolutely outraged the other day because the Orthodox have discovered a way of making the Arab the whole city of Baltimore, so now they can move and even carry something on Shabbat. And she was outraged. I said, look, you can say the cup is half full, you can say the cup is half empty. Here they've taken the intent of that law and applied it to a modern city of roughly 2 million people, which certainly was not the case when the halakha went in, when your village was 200 people. And it matches the life of today and still holds on to what was important in the interpretation. But this
with
needs
this
to
kind
take
of
place.
Enlightened viewpoint, what is your attitude towards the role of women in Israel? There's been a book recently published.
Which is an absolute horror.
Okay. I only read reviews, so I don't know.
The only review that was worth reading was Alice Shalvey's. And this woman...
She was my English teacher at the university.
Well, she is extraordinary. She's one of the really great people. This woman that wrote it taught in the experimental high school that my
yes.
granddaughter went to. And they had a number of screwball teachers there, and she was the most screwball of them all. And I wouldn't be bothered reading the book,
all right, but
I gathered
okay,
from what
so
I've read.
Okay, so let's
about.
Take a more responsible person like Shulamit Aloni. You may not agree with her all the way, but do you agree that women are discriminated against?
Look, every time somebody calls me up and asks me about discrimination, I ask them how long they've been in Israel. It's usually 3 months. I tell them after they've been there 3 years, please to call me up, and then I'll tell them whether I'll join them or not. That goes for Shulamit. She's got to make, after all, if you're a politician, you have to oversay anything in order to get any kind of support. And I do not expect Israel to be the prime example of liberated women
okay.
for all over the world.
Okay, you've made your point.
They were, incidentally, in the early kibbutzim,
right.
where they didn't allow women to have children, as you know,
well, it was
because they couldn't
made
by them. Do a man's work. If they had children.
Do you have any kibbutz connections at present?
Yes, of course. Founders of the kibbutz Hazareya are members of my family from Germany. And one of the family, of my mother's side of the family, lived initially not in Alunim. She ended in Alunim, but left there about 17, 18 years ago. Her children were born there.
I just saw in the Hadassah magazine that Irma Lindheim has died.
Yes.
I saw her in Berkeley about 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you met her when you were in Israel.
Oh, certainly. I knew Irma long before Israel, because she was a friend of the family, and her husband's partner was a cousin of our family. So
for the record, Irma Lindheim was the second president of Hadassah. I mean, it should be on
yes.
the tape. The reason I asked about Irma, because reading about your involvement in Brandeis, when you were past 30, past 40.
I was 50 when I went to Brandeis.
Reminded me of Irma Lindheim going back to school when she was a mature woman. And I think she took up the cello when she was 47 or something like that, and then took singing lessons, and almost got ordained.
Yes, they weren't ordaining women.
But almost.
I can only tell you from my Pittsburgh experience.
Yes, please do.
Of watching committees that started with 30 men and 4 women and got to be 14 women and 20 men and 24 women and 10 men, that this is a very good reason not to have women ordained.
Because women take over?
No, the men back away. The women have time, and they let them take over little by little. You've got more time than I have, and therefore you go do it. And little by little, the women doing the work also want the major's say, which is quite correct. They have every reason to. And the Jewish wisdom in one of my non-knowledgeable Reform children who know nothing, because by the third generation Reform you don't know anything, wanted to know why the women were separated. And I said, well, if she'd ever gone to a synagogue where the young women come, their children run all over the place, and they run downstairs and see Papa, but when it gets really serious, they come back up to Mama, and if something occurs and they need to go to the bathroom or need a bottle or want to be nurse, Mama's there to do it, but not under the nose of the bima or anything else that's going on. Perfectly silly. That's my point of view,
okay,
obviously.
Okay, I'm not going to argue with you. It's not mine, but I'm not going to argue with you. I'm very interested in this adult studies program that you led in Pittsburgh, mainly because Louise Freund, in her interview, mentioned being a part of a group that you taught. And what gave you the idea of starting? Was it your idea, or did somebody come to you and say, teach us?
Yeah, somebody came to me. It was Florence Rosenstein.
Yes.
I was teaching at the College of Jewish Studies. Mm-hmm. And I'm no good with 14-year-olds. Because that's a discipline problem, and I'm a good lecturer, I'm not a good teacher. There's quite a difference. The older group that I had, which were seniors in high school and freshmen at college, I did a little better. But I was teaching the Middle Ages, and they complained because I had to teach them about the... this is where I lose words. The
Crusades.
And they didn't know anything. They didn't know any European history, so they complained that I taught them too much. Well, you can't teach Jewish history unless you know some history. But Florence had asked me if I would do it, and so there were 7 or 8, and we did it for 5 years. We had a wonderful time, and Louise remembers it for a very good reason. I didn't allow them to deal with texts, and I never dealt with the Bible. I would start with the return after Cyrus. And if we had gone on, I would do biblical history, but they have to know a great deal more. Otherwise, they ask all the wrong questions, and you have to teach the course so the questions are answered before they're asked. Louise was about to make a trip around the world, so I gave her an assignment of travelers who had been going to Palestine over the generations, and I think starting in the 9th century, maybe even earlier. excerpts, and she came in hysterics. Every one of them said, we didn't take the right clothes. Nothing's changed.
Marion Cabot and I were just talking. She's packing for her trip, and that's what's driving her. She can't figure out what are the right clothes to take for her trip. But you mean for Palestine? What were the right clothes in Palestine? Have any of your children or grandchildren become interested in the Jewish world? And I know they're Jewish, but in Israel, in living in Israel, in the Jewish religion, and involving themselves in Jewish identity?
I can't answer that directly because I honestly don't know. Any family, and I can tell you this historically in any generation, any country you want, the people who are the German word is Vorsteher, and I don't know what the English word is. The people who, it was Leon Falk who argued for Kashrut, separate, slightly more money during the Depression to the Mellons and the Heinzes and all the other people that you sat with when you were allocating funds.
This is very interesting. You mean during the period when they were allocating funds for poor people in Pittsburgh?
During the Depression, during
the welfare,
when a quarter of the population
was... He felt
that
Jews should get more because they observed Kashrut. I didn't know this.
They
this
needed
very interesting.
More.
Yes,
because
well, I know because I grew up in a Jewish family which was on welfare.
Sure.
So I know.
So you got... But. And I wrote them out, these pieces of paper that you took to the butcher and the ones that went to the grocer.
Well, and New York didn't have that.
Leon argued for this. Now, people who are always in the center, speaking up for the Jewish community to the non-Jewish community, the chancellor of the university, Bowman, never understood why we wouldn't go to Rolling Rock. Our farm is beyond it. I said, look, and socialized with these people. I said, I wasn't interested in it on a social level. I wanted my children to marry Jews, and the only way they'll marry Jews is if their life is, it's bad enough, bad isn't the wrong word, but in an open situation, in school and in college, the chances of their meeting Jewish children is very slim. They are the ones that they will fall in love with. So all kinds of things happen, and always to the families that are out front, because they're always up against. And in order to do for the community what they do, a great many of the taboos that one in the world of a couple hundred years ago, it's possible that because it was accepted outside, a Jew would not need to sit down to table mm-hmm. with a non-Jew. Mm-hmm. But today you couldn't. And you can't. I have problems when I come to visit, because having not observed all my life in this country, I was served crabs the other day, and this 79-year-old distant cousin of mine who was treating me in Baltimore to the nicest thing she had gone on, especially that morning. What do? If you no longer eat shellfish? I ate it, incidentally. It stuck here, but I couldn't put...
You didn't want to hurt her feelings.
I couldn't hurt... The human thing is much more important than the discipline part of it. But in any event, I can say only this, and this is the answer that I gave when Anne Ross Hyman and Philip Hyman came to visit me this winter with their sons, Steve, who is 21 or 2, and their daughter, who's 18. Steve grew up, Philip grew up here, the Hyman family, who are completely Reformed Jews, to the point where he was astonished that my boys had been bar mitzvah and didn't know until 10 years ago what the word meant. And in any event, they asked my Foreign Office cousin and me the evening before they left, what would happen if all the American Jews actually pulled up stake and came to Israel to live? After all, we'd lose all the political clout of the Jews here, and we'd lose money. Hanan gave whatever answer is the usual answer. I actually didn't listen after the first few words because I began to think. My mother had 11 grandchildren. since I've been in Israel in 1964, 10 of the 11 grandchildren have been to visit. Mm-hmm. And the only one who hasn't won't fly, and he's a doctor. So he can't take off 4 weeks of traveling on a boat and the 2 or 3 weeks in Israel, because that's more time than a doctor can spare. Of my 15 grandchildren, 10 have been there, even though I don't think it's fair to count the 10th. He was 5 months old and had very little choice since he was still nursing and had to go where Mama went. But 9 of them have been there. And whether they are professing Jews or non, where the mothers are not Jewish, they're not, in my book, they still have been. They have a very warm feeling. They follow what goes on. My children all do. I was astonished the other day at my son Sigo's house, where Jean Davis's mother has an 80th birthday, and her twin brother with two of his children, and her brother John, who lives here with his wife and their two, came for dinner. And Mary Davis, whom I haven't seen since Jean's wedding 17 years ago, said, "We worry about you all the time." They're not Jewish.
Oh, I didn't know that.
No, no.
The
no,
name
no.
Davis is very
no,
neutral.
No, no. One of their brothers is a minister. They asked Sigo to convert, and he wouldn't. The children go to church with their mother, as they quite properly should.
But that doesn't disturb you at all?
She didn't say that.
Well, she said, you said it's quite...
You don't get between husband and wife. And since halakha says that the children of a Gentile are Gentile children, what happens from now on, I can't answer for. That if one of them marries back into the Jewish fold and decides to become a Jew, who's to say no? This has happened before. But the history of my kind of family is the history of the Muranos. 9/10 of them disappeared in Spanish society, and the very few that maintained their Judaism and got away from Spain returned to Judaism and were so far removed from it that they had to keep their own synagogues, had nothing to do with Ashkenazi Jews. I presume you know that the Inquisition only burned new Christians. They never touched a Jew. They only touched the Jews who had converted. And this most people, for some reason or other, don't seem to take seriously when they read their history.
It's interesting that you have noted that you have relatives both from your mother's side and from your father's side who live in Israel and have become Israelis, coming directly from Germany?
No. Actually, yes, because the two girls from my mother's side of the family came from Berlin, and one of them, I think Hava couldn't have been over 14, Maria must have been 17 or 18. She was in love with one of the boys in the Zionist group, and that's why she joined.
And saved her life.
Well, they came out of Germany in 36 or 7, and their parents went to England.
I wonder if we could go back to Pittsburgh. We've talked about your life in Israel a little bit. I'm sure that you've been a little bit modest. I'm sure that your involvement is a bit more than you've said, besides providing a living room for people to have meetings in, that you've had a little bit of input, too.
I have one advantage over lots of people. I do know a good many people. And since I am able to put some money into the Jerusalem Foundation, I am allowed by the foundation, providing the board approves, and naturally, to make allocations to things that other people aren't interested in. The archives were rotting in a room that they had for the city of Jerusalem. And I could put a little bit of money in to get started of cleaning it up, and now the city's undertaken, mm-hmm. and it's become something. I've put seed money, since I'm not the wealthy folk one.
Yes, I understand.
But, you know, $1,000 or $2,000, if you know where it's needed. There was a project, a community project. They needed to fund, and that actually was $2,000, that's her total wage, a social worker for a year to deal with the kids who had dropped out and who were the potential dropouts, mm-hmm. to see what they could do about this, and they had no money for it. Now, this has been funded now for 3 years, and the Ministry of Welfare, once you've proven the need, will take it over. Now, this kind of thing, because
how
I live
there. How do
these
things come to your attention?
Because the man who just died, Lewis Horowitz, who was doing this job in the city, he was one of the top people in the JDC, and they dropped him unceremoniously, much too early, and he came and volunteered his services to Teddy for $1 a year.
For the record, Teddy Kollek, mayor of Jerusalem.
Jerusalem, and Lewis Horowitz, who was the director of JDC Overseas Work, and had been stationed in Israel at one point for 5 years. And he started with one very deprived area to get them to act for themselves, but you need to know how to do it. There's one sad thing in Israel. Very often, people are invited to come over and head departments in universities or projects that are being funded because they've made their reputation. And they're actually dealing with, they made their reputation in the past 20 years, and they've got a fixed idea of how to proceed. The situation in Israel is 20 years later and doesn't fit this fixed idea, but what we get taught is something that's already no longer valuable. And so community organization was not taught in the social work schools and is only now beginning, because the head of it was a very famous American woman who got it started, and the people who followed were trained by her, and it was the last word from the United States, but it wasn't the right word for Israel. And this goes on in many places. So that sometimes when some breakthrough occurs like this thing, and I happen to be good friends of both husband and wife and play Scrabble once a week with the wife who's a writer and puts up with my bad spelling. And knowing what was going on, because I'm, after all, I have enough experience from this country that I'm interested. And since he also knew no Hebrew and always had to have an interpreter with him, it wasn't very hard to take me along and show me a few things. That's how it happens.
And this is it.
Or I read the Post and read about something. Alice Shalvey's school for Orthodox, high school for Orthodox girls, which is an extraordinary thing that's going.
I didn't know about it. I haven't read it.
And because her feeling is that Orthodox girls need a strictly Orthodox education, but that within the frame of that, there are all kinds of possibilities that aren't shown them in the ordinary school, if they go to high school at all. There are now three high schools for Orthodox girls. And I think Alice's is the one that offers the widest gamut, but they all do something. Because before that, they weren't even going into high school, except in the Orthodox kibbutzim, who allowed, I want you to know, their children to go to university long before HaShomer HaTzair would, because they were afraid they'd learn something.
Well,
it was not.
That was a nice little snide
communist
remark for HaShomer HaTzair. By the way, Alice Shalvey's husband is a landsman of mine, because he's from Brooklyn.
A darling guy.
Those were very interesting comments. I was going to say, let's go back to Pittsburgh, and you brought in some very interesting
things
from Jerusalem.
I've been away from Pittsburgh for 32 years.
Do you really call it 32 years? And yet
I've been divorced that long, and I was back here once for 5 years.
Yes, well, that was the period I was wondering about, 1959 to 1990. That's when I met you. once, I think.
Yeah, well,
and you wrote for the Chronicle.
Well, where did you live then?
Well, you wrote book reviews.
Well, maybe once or twice.
Where did you live during this period? You were at Brandeis? In other words, you were a gypsy.
I was in New York for 8 years.
I see.
Doing mostly UJA speaking. I was the head of the National Speakers Bureau of the lay speakers when they wanted to know if it was a job or a title. And I had the time for them to find out. And
I see. I'm sorry. This doesn't really make it clear that you did live in New York during that period.
I was in New York from 47 to 55.
Mm-hmm.
I was at Brandeis from 55 to 59. I was here from 59 to 64 when I moved to Israel.
And now you
and
have
in
your
all those periods,
domicile.
I went to Israel off and on. And because obviously, if you're talking for UJA, I was at the meeting that set up bonds in Israel. And
here's one question that people have answered variously. How do you view your accomplishments, successes, and failures? Since all the people we interview are people who are at least 60 years old, we're assuming that they have had accomplishments, successes, and failures. And would you care to answer that?
I think that if you were in a profession, you would be able to answer that. I'm not sure that... that I've had a very full life, yes. That every bad thing that's happened, either physically or psychologically, at some point has proven a benefit when I've had to face it or help somebody else face it, no question about that. Because every experience broadens you. And,
well, then let's
I don't
go
know
to,
what
another,
else to, say.
To another question about Pittsburgh. You lived in Pittsburgh for
21 years.
Do you have any special impressions about Pittsburgh that you can recall now? When you come back to visit, do certain things strike you differently?
No, I really haven't enough contact with the community to come up with anything that's even vaguely useful. Or even sensible, because I just plain don't know what goes on here. And
were you at all involved when your brother became a part of that special elite group in 1947, which was collecting arms material for Israel? You remember the famous meeting that Leonard Slater writes about, and where he omitted Alex Lowenthal's name.
The list isn't correct, and three-quarters of the facts aren't correct, according to my brother.
Yeah.
But Rudolph had a stroke 20-odd years ago, never got his speech back fully.
I didn't know
so
that.
That's why it's very difficult to get... And
but
of
were
course,
you in any way involved
in
that?
Oh, everybody was involved, of course. If you went off to speak for UJA, somebody'd come up afterwards and say, I can get 100 stretches for you at $1 apiece. Do you want them? And I'd say, when I get back to New York, I'll tell the office, give me your name and address. Nobody. You never had... There were people, of course, who had much closer connections than that. But we all went to the meetings, if we were in New York, that were held behind closed doors at the McAlpin. And there's one cute story. Al Robeson, who was Rudolph's right-hand man, got up in absolute hysterics. Some bra manufacturer had given a whole lot of brassieres for the girl army, and they were marked A cup, B cup, and C cup, and they'd been put in with the kitchen utensils and plates and things and were lost for 3 months. And it had been found...
Because they were cut.
Of course, the kids stacking these things wouldn't know what an A cup was from a B cup from a C cup.
Oh, that's funny.
Isn't that a wonderful...
I've just been reading Teddy Kollek's autobiography, in which he describes some of the hectic days of the being over the Copacabana. They called it the Copa Haganah, where they were collecting things and so on.
Oh, you're always running into people who...
Well, we had a meeting at Young People's
Yeah.
called We Were There. I was the moderator, and various members of Young People stood up in the course of this and described what they were doing from November 47 to May 1948.
Yeah, well, of course, this started long before that. But you know, people who had come back from the army, who at college would get people who had kept their guns to bring them, and then would hide them under the table before they could get them wrapped up. And oh no, of course, we were, as always, we knew enough not to know any more than we needed to know. Nobody asked any questions. I wouldn't say nobody, but certainly the 10,000 of us scattered over the country who
You
had,
think there were 10,000 people involved?
Oh, I know
involved.
There were. And you never knew who would show up at the McAlpin.
Mm-hmm.
And there'd be a sandwich on the table, piece of pie. The waiter would bring the coffee and pour it, and then he would be put out and the door would be locked. There could be five waiters, but that... and you never knew, you didn't even ask the names of the people you sat next to or where they came from. You just sat and you talked to people because obviously you're all in it together. But the less you knew, the better.
There was a great deal of trust then that you assumed that people would take the money and use it properly.
Well, there was no money.
Well, for purchasing planes and so on, you needed money.
That was not done at public meetings. That was done quite differently, but the meeting once a week with somebody who came over from Israel or one of the boys from Teddy's office, bringing in a list of what was needed and giving some report, if there was a report that could be public. But anybody who had any...